Welcome to the Creative Pen Podcast. I'm Joanna Penn, thriller author and creative entrepreneur, bringing you interviews, inspiration, and information on writing, publishing options, and marketing ideas for your book. You can find the episode show notes, your free author blueprint, and lots more information at thecreativepen.com. And that's pen with a double N. And here's the show. Hello, creatives. I'm Joanna Penn, and this is episode number 329 of the podcast. And it's Saturday, 8th of July, 2017, as I record this. Today, I'm talking to Rachel Aaron, author of 2K to 10K and a fantasy author, about how to write fast, publish slowly, and focus your author marketing. So that is coming up. And first, a correction to last week's show. Those of you who are attuned to accents might have realized the delightful Sean Black is actually Scottish, not Irish, as I said in my intro and things. And it's funny, because he lives in Dublin, I had it in my head that he was Irish. And then, of course, I listened to the recording and went, oh, he's Scottish. You idiot. So I got confused. So apologies about that. And thanks to everyone who spotted that not so deliberate mistake. Okay, so personal update this week. There's nothing too exciting happening in publishing. So straight into the personal update. I launched How to Market a Book this week, the fully updated third edition, available now in ebook and print and audiobook if you buy direct, coming soon to Audible and iTunes. We're having one of those technical issues where they send back your files for leveling or whatever it is. So sorting that out should be available on Audible and iTunes by the end of the month. Thankfully, thank you to everyone who bought the book and pre-ordered it and everything. It hit number one in several categories on Amazon within the first few hours, which is very important when your book is a book on book marketing. It would have been pretty embarrassing if I couldn't get the book to rank well. So thanks to everyone who bought a copy. And there's a lot of updated material and new chapters. So if you own the older second edition written in 2014, you will still find value in the third edition. And I hope it helps everyone with your author marketing. So I also walked 50 kilometres last Saturday up the first leg of the Cotswold Way from Bath to Wootton-under-Edge, if you know this part of the world. It was a glorious day. It was quite hot, to be fair, but it was gorgeous. And I did the 50 in just under 11 and a half hours. Of course, you do have a couple of breaks along the way, but mainly it's just get it done. And I know last year I did the 100K Race to the Stones and I said I'd never do another ultra, but I did. And I'm actually intending to do more. So I was reflecting on this because, of course, after last year, I was a complete wreck. My feet were a wreck and I didn't do a good job of looking after myself on the trail. And this time with the 50, I did a lot better. Big tip, if you're doing these type of longer events, change your socks at every stop and use Compeed plasters plus padding plus tape plus codeine earlier on. So I was stiff for a couple of days and had some blisters on my hands from my walking bowls and just one on my feet. So generally, you know, I was fine. The usual sort of painful muscles from doing that much in one day, but physically it was good. And I'm keen to do more. And why? Well, I'm a goal orientated person and I find that these types of challenges help me to keep going in between. So if I know that there's an event coming, I will make sure I walk more regularly in order to keep training for that. So if you're, you know, and this is something I think a lot about is as writers, you know, we're more used to using our brains than our bodies. And a lot of writers have a lot of physical pain and issues. And so this is interesting because I think I've mentioned it, but I'm co-writing a book on sort of health for writers with a doctor at the moment. And so thinking about this a lot and how we can maintain our health as long as we can. Also,
walking for me is a kind of meditation. I do yoga now and I do meditate when I'm at yoga, but I'm not someone who finds it easy to not think a lot. And what I find with these longer walks, after about 25 kilometers, you quit thinking about much except putting one foot in front of the other. And it also helps to put a lot of things into perspective. And I mean, I do talk about this in How to Market a Book about, you know, the things we should be focusing on. But when you are physically tired, then you realize the most important thing is shelter and water and food and rest and someone to take care of you. And that puts, you know, all the little obsessions with ranking and how much money you're making today and, you know, comparing yourself to other authors. And there's always someone to compare yourself to. Oh, yes, there is. So, I mean, that never stops. Even if you become super successful and people are like, wow, you're so successful, you still compare yourself to people who are more successful. I wonder who J.K. Rowling compares herself to. But I think we all compare ourselves to somebody. And the other thing is that an acquaintance, I didn't really know her, but someone in the crime writing community died last week early, of cancer. And I thought of her as I walked and how you just don't know how much time you have. And we need to use our bodies while we're still alive. And, you know, if we're lucky enough to be mobile and lucky enough to be able to do these things, then do it. And of course, what's lovely about the walk as well is there are the super fit. I mean, as I finished my 50, that people had run straight through the 100. So, I mean, there's always people in front of you. And then also you pass on the route the people who are a lot slower than you. And you're like, yay, I'm great. Until you realize the people who are ahead of you. So it's a good metaphor for the author journey. But mainly it's that kind of, you know, memento mori, remember, we will all die. You know, I like thinking about this. I think it's important. I mean, it puts our lives in perspective. And I think that's something that we should all do. And that will focus us on, why are we writing? Why do you want to finish this book? When are you going to finish this book if you're someone who needs a bit of a kick? And the other thing is, these setting goals and then achieving these goals help you realize how much you can actually do. And so I hope that encourages you today. I'm also booking my walk for next year. I'm committing to the Isle of Wight Challenge, which is in May 2018, which is 108 kilometers around the island. I haven't decided yet whether I'll do the half one again, so the one day 54k or whatever it is, or whether I will do the whole 108. But I am this time, I mean, I tend to do these things on my own and I don't talk much along the way, but I am going to start a writer's team, which is way outside my comfort zone. But that is part of what I'm talking about. So I haven't booked it yet, but I'm going to look at making a decision on that quite soon. I find booking these things very important for the mindset thing. And so if you fancy walking around the Isle of Wight in May 2018, you can email me, joanna@thecreativepen.com. And I'm going to be starting a little writer's team and putting it out to the writer's community here in the UK to see if other people want to do it. I think having healthy and fit writers is a very good idea. Also this week, I was on the Sci-Fi and Fantasy Marketing podcast talking about an international spin on book marketing. What's funny is if you are American, you might have noticed I'm often trotted out to talk about international things. So I share some good marketing for international books tips, also talk about translation, rights licensing and more. So check that out at marketingsff.com and episode 139, or the link will be in the show notes. Talking of international, from this side of the pond, I am off to New York on Monday for Thriller Fest. If you are going to Thriller Fest, please do come and say hello. I will be tweeting and sharing pictures of me with all my author friends on Facebook and Instagram and Twitter and all that. And I'll also be going to the Craft Fest sessions, and I will be sharing my lessons learned and my tips that I pick up on a podcast in a couple of weeks' time. The conference is awesome. I mean, I love it. Is this my third or fourth time? I think it might be my fourth time. But basically every year I learn a lot and I meet some of my kind of thriller author heroes. There's also the awards dinner. And I may have mentioned that I'm a finalist for the best ebook original for Destroyer of Worlds, one of my arcane thrillers, and I'm super thrilled about it. Ta-da. And Jonathan and I, so Jonathan's coming with me. It will be his kind of first outing he's never been to New York. So his first time in New York, but also his first sort of outing as thriller author husband. What's nice about Thriller Fest is a lot of the spouses and partners come and, you get to meet people doing all kinds of crazy things. And yes, I'm also intending to visit the Amazon bookstore in New York to have a look at that. So I'll be sharing everything as usual with you guys. All right, so thanks for all your emails and tweets and comments this week. A couple of people, Suki Jutler and Natalie Roberts, both said, Suki said, a brilliant episode, couldn't stop laughing at Sean's comments and honesty. Natalie said, listened while updating my website, love Sean, very honest, and you both had me laughing. So I'm super glad because, you know, I'm not someone who, who makes people laugh, so I'm glad Sean did. Els Lewis, I think, or L. Lewis. Oh, that is just murdered. Sorry, L. Listening to the podcast to 10x my writing. Excellent. I hope the dictation helped with that. I'm certainly loving dictation still. I'm just shy of 40,000 words on the first draft of the fantasy. James Lee Schmidt said, really enjoyed the podcast. Well, whatever I see you on, you always seem to be bubbly and having a good time. Where can I get that? And that was listening to the Marketing SSFF podcast. And I had, because that was filmed in the evening, it was recorded in the evening, I had had a couple of gin and tonics. So that always helps. But I generally am enthusiastic because I love what I do. So yeah, there you go. Shannon Sinclair says, after listening to the podcast with Scott Baker, I was thrilled to find version 4 of Dragon on my Apple and does happy dances. Awesome. Rose Arrow Smith Deku sent some cool happy face and sad face and happy face pictures saying, before literary rejection angst, after listening to the Creative Pen podcast, thanks for the episode about 10-year goals. And of course, the after picture was the happy face. Thank you, Rose. Joanna Slodonik, listening to the show while sailing in Croatia, and sent me some gorgeous pictures of sunny sailing. Croatia's just brilliant. We cycled through the islands a couple of years ago, from across the island and then on a little ferry to the next island. And it's a beautiful country. In fact, Jonathan would love to buy a place there. But hey, we're leaving Europe. So that's, maybe not going to happen. But there you go. Definitely recommend Croatia. Tracy Barnhart, listening to the podcast on a run. I was over a mile from the car when the rain started. Still looked like a lovely run, Tracy. C. Stephen Manley, listening to the show while hiking in McMullen Cove near Huntsville, AL. I presume AL is Alabama, which looked awesome. Andrew Einspruck, a delightful and informative episode with Sean Black. Thanks for making my commute to work in Canberra, Australia, fun and useful. Awesome. And just a couple more. Benjamin Douglas, listening while doing some much needed lawn work in Iowa. Glamorous. And Suzanne, this morning I was out running near Munich in Germany while listening to the show. So I always love to hear, how many continents we can hit with the podcast listeners. So thank you to that, everybody. And also just a comment from Monica Rodriguez, who sent me an email and said she's been listening to the show since 2011. And says, the biggest difference from what I tend to hear from other writers is that I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid no one will buy my book because at first they won't. I'm not afraid of negative reviews because they all count. I know that by working with an editor and cover designer, I can put out high quality work. I know I have to work hard to market it, but I won't put too much time or money into that until my third book. I know what to expect and I feel prepared. And it was great to hear that from Monica because these are all really good, realistic things that are mainly true in the author environment. And I guess that's, you know, I feel like partly my mission is to help people do better and share my journey along the way. And Monica's been listening since 2011. And in 2011, you know, I left my day job in September 2011. So before that, I was still working a day job. I published my first novel in 2011. I, you know, was not making much money at all from publishing in 2011. So it's, you know, this is a journey and we learn lots along the way. And if we put it into action, things change. So thank you, Monica, and to everyone who emails about what they learn on the show. So today's show is sponsored by my own How to Write a Novel course, which I created while writing End of Days. So you get a behind the scenes look at how the book came together. The course has videos, audios and slides, so you can do it at your own pace. There's also a private Facebook group where you can ask any questions. So is it for you? Is it your dream to write a novel, but you just don't know where to start? Have you started writing only to run out of ideas? Are you suffering from self-doubt about whether you're good enough to write a novel? Do you feel overwhelmed by all the information and craft books out there? If you've answered yes to any of these questions, the course might be for you. One course member, Lee Anderson, said, "This course is exactly what I was looking for. I now feel well on the way to writing and completing my first draft. It has been a real breakthrough." And another student, Rana, said, "I'm learning a lot, more than I ever did doing other courses," which of course makes me very happy. So find out more at thecreativepen.com/write-novel. Okay, so this kind of sponsorship and product placement pays for the hosting and transcription, but my time in producing the show is primarily sponsored by you guys. So a big thank you to all the people supporting on Patreon. Thanks to new patrons this week, Helena Holm, Jennifer Sivek, and Robin Lyons. I really do appreciate your support on Patreon, like the tweets and emails. It really demonstrates that people enjoy the show and want it to continue. And on Patreon, you can support the show with just a couple of dollars a month, a coffee or two a month, and you'll get the extra monthly Q&A audio, which I recorded and sent out this week. So there's a brand new audio extra. I think it was about 45 minutes extra this week. And you can add your questions for next time for the August show if you are a supporter. You can support the show at patreon.com, patreon.com/thecreativepen. Thank you. Right, let's get on with the interview with Rachel. Today, I'm here with Rachel Aaron. Hi, Rachel.
Hello, thanks so much for having me.
Oh, it's great to have you on the show. Just a little introduction. Rachel is the fantasy author of the Heartstrikers and Eli Mompress series, as well as writing science fiction under Rachel Bark. She's also the author of 2K to 10K, How to Write Faster, Better, and Write More of What You Love, which I read when it first came out and I reread in preparation for this, and it's still a classic.
Thank you so much.
Oh, no worries. So just start off by telling us a bit more about you and your writing and publishing journey, because sometimes it can seem to people that we emerge fully formed.
Oh yes, no, this is one of those overnight successes that was 10 years in the making kind of thing. And I started writing back in 2004. That's when I really got serious about writing. I just graduated from college and I had like this really cruddy job where I didn't do anything, and I'm like, I'm gonna write my book. I have no responsibilities, I have no excuses, I'm gonna write it. And so I wrote a book, and it didn't sell. And this is before self-publishing, you know, so it was agents, and traditional publishing was pretty much the only option at that stage in time. If you self-publish, something was wrong with you, you know, and it was because you couldn't make it in New York, basically. And that is not true and never has been true. But at that time, that was the mindset that everyone had. So I was desperate to make it in New York. And so I wrote a book and it got rejected by everyone. And, you know, in hindsight, it probably deserved it. It was not a very good book. But then I wrote the book that became The Spirit Thief, which is now the first book in my Legend of Eli Mompress. Ta-da!
Wow, that's a hefty book for those on the audio.
This is actually three books. This is the omnibus edition. And it was the one I had on hand. And but it was and I sold that to Orbit Books in, I think, 2008. And it came out in 2010. And I also did my Fortune's Pawn science fiction series under the name Rachel Bach with, I don't know if you can see it, but Orbit Books, which is right there.
Yeah.
And they were lovely, but I'm a very do-it-myself person, and I quickly got very tired of people telling me it has to have this cover. No, we didn't talk to you. It was marketing. You know, the stuff that you hear a lot in New York. And I at that time, I'd made a bunch of indie friends because I'd been going to conventions. And this is, you know, we're now in like 2013, and I'm meeting these people at conventions who had a quarter of my sales, but were making twice as much money as I did. And I was like, I think something is wrong. So I was like, I'm going to do it. I'm going to go indie. I have this crazy, weird dragon series. No one in New York's going to want it anyway. It's just so bizarre. You know, I can't even describe it. It's like cyberpunk and dragons and future Detroit and mages. And it's just, I loved it, but it was not one of my biggest kind of problems that I had in trad publishing was that I didn't fit neatly on a bookshelf. I tended to write these books that blended genres. Like Fortune's Pawn is action science fiction with kissing. You know, and the Eli books are epic fantasy, but in an urban fantasy voice and pace. So they're very fast. This isn't like, you know, this isn't Game of Thrones. Mm. It's this very kind of fast, almost this love letter to 90s fantasy with big action sequences and big characters. And I didn't fit anywhere. And so Dragons definitely wasn't going to fit anywhere, my Dragons books. So I was like, I'm going to self-publish them. And my first one, Nice Dragons Finish Last, which is right here. And I love this cover. It's my favorite covers. That was the other reason I went indie. I got to do my own covers. I love it. I was a graphic designer before I became an author.
Ah, right. So, that helps.
Very useful career before being an author. And it's went gangbusters. It's been enormously successful. It's won tons of awards. I actually just won the Romantic Times Editor's Pick Award for No Good Dragon Goes Unpunished, which is this one. And that's the third book in the Dragon series. And that's my second RT award for the series. And I've never had a series that's done this well. And I did it with indie. And it's been absolutely amazing. And I'm very happy.
Wow. And it's great that you started by saying you're like the 10-year overnight success. And so 2004, obviously, we're kind of at 13 years at this point. But it's really great to hear that you've done both sides. And it's so kind of odd now to hear like 2006. And I'd forgotten that indie wasn't around then. I mean, but
you've got to forget that it's before 2009. There wasn't a Kindle Direct Publishing. There wasn't KDP. It just didn't exist.
Yeah. And that just changed everything. So people coming in now, you hear people complaining and it's like, no, this is amazing. It's still amazing and getting even better.
I remember when indie people's first, when my indie friends, like I actually met John Hartness in Carolinas, who's a hilarious dude and writes really funny books. And he's been indie pretty much since, I think this is the beginning. I don't think he's ever done any trad pub. And I met him at Con Carolinas and he was just this dude with a table full of books. And I just started talking to him about his numbers. And because, you know, authors get together, we talk numbers, is what we do. Mm. Talk shop, can't stop us. And I was just like, there is absolutely no way you are making this much money. There's no way you are earning these numbers. That is ludicrous and insane. And I just kind of went and looked it up and I was like, wow. It was like seeing the keyhole, the garden through the keyhole, you know, and I just had to go and get in myself.
Oh,
because I'm a really do-it-yourself person. Mm. Very, very much like to be my own boss and make my own decisions. I don't like people telling me what to do. So yeah, it was a natural fit.
I think that's really important to remember as well. But let's, and of course you've mostly written fiction, but you have this one nonfiction, 2K to 10K.
And it's funny. It was like my one good idea. It was like the one big idea that I had. And I've tried to do other nonfic and I hate writing nonfiction. I just hate it.
I saw that on your blog. It made me laugh. But what's interesting is, I think that book was the first book in the writing productivity niche, like the serious, the Chris Fox came after and Monica Lionel and people like that. So let's get back to that. I mean, there are still people who think that writing fast means bad quality. And I know it's like this question comes up a lot, but I wanted to hear your take on that.
When you sent me the questions, I was really debating about how mean I was going to get on this answer.
You can get mean.
Because I am not a mean person. I try to be like the most positive person in every room because no one's got time in their lives for that kind of negativity. It just drags it down. But this question more than any, this thing makes me the maddest of just about anything people say to me. And they'll say it to my face. You know, oh, you write 10,000 words a day? You must be writing shit. Yeah. Or your words must be crap. And I just want to strangle them because look, I am a professional author. My time is money. Mm. Every day I sit in my chair and I write for about 6 to 7 hours a day, sometimes 8 if like things are going really hot. Mm. I don't have time to throw away 50% of what I write. That's stupid. No one has time for that. If I was writing 10,000 words an hour and throwing, and if half of it was crap and I was throwing it away, it would be easier to just go slower and write 5,000 good words.
Mm.
But I don't do that. I write 10,000 words a day. I have lots of books. They're all very highly rated. They're successful. I don't say this to brag, but to point out that objectively, my writing is not crap. Mm. I have 700 people on Amazon who say it's good. I'm a, you know, go with them and, you know, with the star ratings. And what I really think, so it's just objectively wrong. I'm obviously not doing that. And the 2K to 10K method isn't about just throwing words at the page. That's stupid. Outside of NaNoWriMo, no one cares about your daily word count but you. It's an internal metric to try and, you know, to help you make yourself better and to help you go faster. The point is to write a good story. And 2K to 10K, the whole idea of it is to remove the indecision, because you spend so much time in writing trying to decide, you know, how to say it, what to say, how to say it, what's the best thing here. Mm-hmm. But a lot of that decision making isn't about the actual words. It's about the characters and their motivations and what's happening in the scene. But the writing is the most time consuming part of writing, the actual writing it out. So what I do is I just take 5 minutes before I write a scene and I write what happens in the scene. I say, in this scene, Eli will do X and he's going to do X for Y reason. And Miranda's going to be mad. You know, I just write it out and it's really simple shorthand. But that way, if I've made a dumb decision with the plot, you very quickly find that out and you can fix it in your notes. It's like sketching a drawing before you paint it. You know, it's just, you're just getting down your ideas. And once you know where you are going, you will write that scene faster. I guarantee it. I will bet you money. If you come to me and you do this, we sit down, I will put $100 on the table and say you will write that scene faster. Because you just can't help it. Like, I don't know if you've ever had a really good writing day. You know when the words are just flowing and you just know exactly what to say? That's what my method aims to make every day like. That's how I try to live every single day. Because that's the good writing. The one when you're going fast.
Mm.
That's when it's super good. At the end of my Fortune's Pawn series, I wrote the last two chapters. I wrote 15,000 words in one day. It is my record of all time. And those words were the only words in the book that almost, I barely touched them with editing because they were perfect. They were exactly what I wanted, because at that point, I knew everything I wanted to say because it was the end of the series and it was the very last book. And it just flowed out of me. And to this day, I'm so proud of that ending. And so the idea is that if you write fast, you must be writing crap. It's just blatantly wrong. And quite frankly, I find it really offensive, because one of my big things is that every writer writes in their own way. You know, I'm not going to slow writers and saying, you must be lazy. You know, I'm not, everyone writes in your own way. If you're writing and you're happy and you're getting your book done, that is all that matters. You are doing it right for you.
Yeah, no, you know? I think that's really good advice, and I'm going to come back on a bit more on the plotting, but I do want to, you know, comment on your writing sort of 5 to 6, 8 hours a day thing. I mean, a lot of people are not writing full time for a start, so people listening, you know, obviously that's not expected unless you're
obviously
full,
not
unless
yeah.
you're full time. But like you say, we are full time writers. And so, you know, if people just hung out at their day job for like 3 hours a day or 1 hour a day, then that wouldn't be like a full day's work. But I do want to comment on stamina, because I think it's actually really hard work to do that. So today I did 4.5 hours. And I'm exhausted. I mean, this is a new series. I'm still trying to work out a lot of what you're talking about. But writing fiction is very tiring. So how have you built up your stamina? If you kind of look back, is it just like muscles, just like starting off smaller and working up?
Well, for me, it was a combination of two things. One, it was just experience. Just I've been at this point, like I've been writing since 2004. I've written, I think 4 million words. I did a total of, you know, I've written a lot, and I just know how to do it. I just get in, I turn it on and I go. And that's just experience. That's just writing. And the more you do anything, you're just going to get faster and better at it. But it's also just my personality. I tend to be a hyper-focused person. I get a job, I get it done. Like if I decide I'm going to clean the kitchen at 9 o'clock at night, we are not going to bed until that kitchen is clean. That's just how it is. You know, I just don't stop. things. And that's just me personally. And I'm not saying that's like the best way to be. That's just how I am. My husband, who also is writing now, and I'm very excited because I think writing books is the absolute best thing anyone can do. It doesn't matter if you want to be published or if you're just doing it for fun or if you dream of being a bestseller, whatever. Writing a book is like, you know, and I'm biased, but I think it's like one of the most beautiful creative processes any human can attempt. So I love it. And, but he, you know,
sorry,
he,
carry
he
on.
He can't do more. He does more than about an hour or 2 hours. He gets really, really exhausted. Mm. And that's just the difference between us as personalities. You know, he's able to multitask a lot better than I am, whereas I'm hyper-focused. And that's, you know, they're both good. We both get the work done. It's just a difference of personality.
Oh, that's great. And we're going to come back to the husband thing a bit later. But that's talking about plotting. I mean, you talked there about, you know, almost the writing beats, a few lines before the paragraph. Now, the 10,000 words a day, for example, that's not every day of the year. So when you're talking about plotting and kind of pre-writing, you know, talk a bit about that process, because I think people in their heads, they're like, oh, you mean every day you get up and write 10,000 words? Like,
If I did that, I would have a lot more books.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. And I think it's really important to be clear that when we say writing, I guess you're talking about the actual typing, but the writing process includes this other pre-work.
Yeah, and for me, I generally will hit between 8,000 and 10,000 words a day in about a 6 hour day on first drafting. Mm. That's my first draft speed. That's when I'm just, I don't, you know, if it's wrong, I'll just go back and fix it later. I just kind of, my goal is just get it down, because, you know, writing is not a performance art. No one is watching. You can throw all of that away and do it again if it's bad. Just get it out there so you can fix it. And that's just kind of my, and there's lots of people who like really like to make it right before they move on. And that's fine. I've just found it's faster for me to just go through it. And every time I freak out, because I do freak out, I'll realize something is wrong. I'm like, oh, I got to go fix it. I'm like, no, Rachel, this is just the first draft. Just write it out. And you can, I make a little note. I say, fix it later. And I just move on with my life. And
so the pre-writing, just explain how you do that.
Well, what I do for my pre-writing is it's actually, and this actually touches on a question that you're going to ask in a bit, but about the series writing. But really, what I do is the number one most important thing about plotting is just you have to know where you're going. You've got to have a place you're going to. You don't have to know every single detail of the journey there, but you've got to know how the book is going to end. Why is it going to end that way? What positions are your characters going to be in when they get to the end? Because if you've ever driven anywhere and you've been lost, it takes forever. It is terrifying. It's meandering. It's awful. That's what writing without a destination is like. You know, you're just, and some people love exploring. I hate it. I hate not know where I'm going. I have to know. It's that goal-driven thing again. And so what I have found that the absolute best thing for plotting for me is to know where I'm going. And then I ask myself, how did I get there? And I just sort of work backwards. And I actually, for my plotting, I actually use a bunch of the strategies from Anatomy of Story right here. John Truby. I have fallen in absolute love with this book. He's not paying me anything. I just think he's amazing. And this is actually for screenplays.
Yes.
And I've been getting a lot of tips about plotting from the screenplay industry, because screenplays, they have nothing to work with. You'll have screenplays where it's like, you know, you may have 30 minutes of dialogue in the whole movie to get everything out. And so these guys, the screenplay people, they know the tricks. They've got fantastic tricks that you can steal for writing your novels. But mostly in my plotting, I focus on where am I going and why am I going there? And then I figure out what is the most, how do my characters make that journey? What decisions lead us to these end goals? To make sure that I get there in a logical and dramatic way, because you got to get there in a fun way. If stuff just goes right, that's a boring book. You know, my kind of thing is that if the book is dragging, just have something go horribly wrong. Take a yes and flip it to a no. And then suddenly you've got all kinds of new stuff going on.
Yeah, that's a really good tip. And I think you're right about the screenwriting. And a lot of authors now are using screenwriting tips and story structure. And I think the structure is important for series, as you mentioned. So when you're doing that plotting, like the first, I started the first book in a new series. And the feeling with a series is, well, as indies, we need series because a lot of our money is made from series. But how do you go about constructing a bigger story arc over the individual book?
I'm going to tell you what I have learned, not what I did, because what I did was wrong. And basically what that was, like when I started the Heartstrikers series and when I started Eli, Both times I just wrote a first book like I liked it. And I had all these big ideas and I knew where I was going, because I think one of the most important things for any long running series is to have a meta plot, have something really big in the world. And I'm not talking like, Luke, I am your father. You know, that's just a reveal. I'm talking about a sweep of the universe style meta plot, something that is fundamentally wrong in your world that this giant series is going to address. You know, the Dark Lord is coming, or we're all really robots or something, some huge problem that your series will address and will attempt to solve or remedy. And what I do is with every book in the series, I take a little step closer or a big step closer to that end. And that's how I determine how long a series is how many books is going to take me to get to the point where my characters are big enough and powerful enough and know enough to actually address the major world problem. And I tend to go very big with this. You know, my books are very sort of fantasy is all about significant personal action. So my books are really all about one group of characters changes the entire world. And that's really huge. And you don't have to go that huge. I just like it. But it really is, if you want to write a series that's not going to meander and get lost, because you have a lot of series where like the tension just falls off and then people don't buy the next book. And that's because you let the tension drop as an author. You gave them a resting spot, and you've always got to be relentlessly pushing toward that larger plot, even as you resolve individual arcs within the story. That is something I learned the hard way after having to rewrite Heartstrikers book 2 like 7 times and Heartstrikers book 3 like 4 times. That's why even though I write 10,000 words a day, I've only had one book a year, because I had this, I wrote myself into this enormously complicated corner, and I was absolutely determined, especially now that I'm indie, I actually have a rule, which is if it's not good, it doesn't print. A book can be bad for 6 months. A book can be late for 6 months, but it is bad forever. That's my rule. So I will not publish. I will be late. I'll miss deadlines. I will not publish a book if I'm not happy with it. And I think as a result, I've ended up with really high quality novels, just because I refuse to, because one of the things I really resented about traditional publishing was the pressure of the deadline. It's like, it doesn't matter. It has to ship. And I'm like, but it's bad. And I really love being able to have more control over that. But anyway, that's sort of my thing with the plotting, is to know where you're going. If nothing else, know where you're going. And even if you're just writing a book with the idea that it might be a series, take a moment and figure out what kind of series do you want that to be. I mean, I sat down to write almost an episodic adventure series about dragons in Detroit, and I ended up with this sprawling epic family drama, because that's just where the characters naturally went. And I was trying to force them into a box that didn't belong, and they were fighting me. And that's why I had to do so many rewrites. And if I just taken a few days at the beginning and realized, wow, Rachel, you have a giant sprawling family drama with almost 100 characters, I would have known this in advance. So yeah, sit down, look at what you're writing, figure out what kind of story it's going to be and where you want to take it. And if that's the story you even want to write, you may be like, I don't want to write a giant sprawling family drama. So at the beginning, before you've written a giant dragon family, that's a good time to perhaps change your mind.
I think that's really good. And I think it's also important to note what you're talking about there is writing fast, but publishing slow. So you're actually that, and that quality check, I think, is something that indies are now, there's almost two schools of thought. There's the write fast, publish fast, you know, the minimal viable product type thing. And then what you're talking about, which I think is much better with fiction. I think nonfiction, you can get away with that approach, write publishing faster. But with fiction, these are books that can last a very long time, 70 years after the death of the author. And, so you want it to be something that will continue selling for a long time.
And I think this is where my traditional background really, really helped me, because when I first started self-publishing, my number one goal was to make it so my self-published books were indistinguishable quality-wise from my New York books. I wanted them to have beautiful covers and beautiful editing and to be error-free and to be really good books. And because I have a very, very loyal readership, and that has followed me through multiple genre changes. And I am very grateful to them, but I earned them by giving them a quality product. If you're just, quite frankly, if you're just writing as fast as you can, you will produce a lot of books and you will probably make a pretty good living. but you're not going to build the readership that's going to take you to the real bestseller status, to being a being a writer who is loved. To deliver that, you have to deliver real quality. And real quality means taking the time to do as many edits as are needed. And sometimes you luck out, you hit it just that first try right out the gate, and it's fantastic. And if that happens, you know, pop the champagne, that's awesome. But a lot of times books need work. I mean, every book I write needs multiple edits because I don't always have all my best ideas at the beginning. Sometimes I get an amazing idea in the middle of the book and I have to write that in. Then I have to change everything to make that idea work. Fine and natural.
Yeah. I also think fantasy, because this series I'm writing is actually urban fantasy. And I'm like, oh, my goodness. Yeah, exactly.
Welcome to the urban fantasy pool.
Yes, thank you. But it's actually a lot bigger. I think fantasy as a genre is a lot bigger than like the action adventure thriller I was writing. You know, it's bigger in word count, but it's also more complicated in that you need to make up a lot more if it's not all real world, for example.
Well, so also,
you pick up those things might develop later, and then you have to go back and fix maybe the earlier draft when your magic system matured or whatever.
Yeah. And also fantasy, especially second world fantasy, where you're making up a magical system, you're making up a new place where people live. You've got to have all your ducks in a row, because if you start messing up the magic system and breaking your own rules, you're going to lose readers' trust. They're just going to be like, this person doesn't know what they're talking about, because you don't. Mm. You're making mistakes in your own. You're God in this world and you're messing it up. And so fantasy is my favorite genre because you can do so much with it. Mm. You can do literally anything with fantasy. And I love reading it. I love writing it. And really sci-fi, the sci-fi I write is just future fantasy. It's just fantasy in the future. And
good point. With I guess a lot more technology and things like that.
Yeah, but I mean, any sufficiently evolved technology is indistinguishable from magic.
Yes. So, Arthur C. Clarke, actually, is that right?
Technology. Yep. And so so what I keep looking over here because I got all my books. I got a little piles of them. And I hold this up. This is actually another thing about the reason it took me a year. This is 180,000 words. This is,
wow. Is that a 6x9?
This is one of the CreateSpace books. Yes. Which, by the way, they did a really good job with it. They really printed it very nicely. I'm quite happy with it.
That's excellent. Okay, let's come back to character, because you mentioned there fantasy is about significant personal actions. And you also put in the book characters with proper agency write their own stories. So how do we create characters like that and relax enough in our writing to let them do their own thing?
Well, this is where, for me, I do a lot of pre-writing. I do a lot of pre-planning with my characters because I love to plan. I love to world build. I like to get everything in line before I write. And especially since I write very complicated books, this is really important, because if I just started writing, I would get confused. And I have gotten confused. And I've had to redo a bunch of rewriting because of stupid stuff that should have worked out before I started. Mm. And that's just me again. This is all very personal. So I'm not telling anyone. Don't just dive in. You're free. If that's how you like it, you're free to do that. This is just how I avoid the problem. And but what I do is I actually, at this point in my writing career, I've kind of evolved to use two methods, a hybrid of two methods. One is called GMC. And I actually talk about this on my blog. But it's not mine. I didn't invent it. I've actually forgotten the woman's name, but I linked to her on the blog. She's fantastic. And she has a book called GMC. And it's goal, motivation, conflict. And it's basically every character who appears in your novel, who is any sort of a role, like if they have a speaking role, they need to have a goal, they need to have a motivation, and they need to have a conflict. Something. So the goal is something they want, or so the goal is something they're trying to get, right? You know, I need a glass of water is my goal. The motivation is, why do I want that glass of water? Well, I am desperately thirsty and will die if I do not drink this glass of water. And the conflict is, there is an alligator between me and the glass of water. It's the reason I can't get what I want. And if you just have those three things for all of your people, you will automatically have a motivated, dynamic cast that's going to go and do their own thing, because they're all going after their own motivations and their goals. They're all running on their own little engines, and you don't really have to do much except figure out how exactly they do that. What are their personalities? And that's the part where I use another system, which is actually, again, anatomy story, the John Truby system, which basically develops characters in parallel with their opponents. And his theory is that basically all stories are the stories of conflict between people. you know, you have your character, who you have your main character who wants a thing, and you have the people who are opposed to that character. And these are not all antagonists. You know, if you have a boy who wants to go out and save the world, and his mother is desperately trying to stop him because she loves him, and she's like trying to get in his way, she is an opponent to him. She is standing in the way of his goals. And what you do is you develop all of these opponents together with your main characters. And like, you know, many books have three opponents. You have sort of a minor opponent, and then a major opponent, and then an opponent who is against the character, but not really. And they often end up becoming an ally. For example, in romance, the two love interests are often opposed. They're often against each other at first. They're competing for different goals, which is what throws them into conflict. And that's the entire idea. You are generating conflict by setting up these people with opposing motivations and goals and things that they want. And he also goes into things that they need but don't know it yet. Like every character will have something that they need to happen to themselves that they don't know it. Maybe they're selfish and they need to learn to be not selfish. But you don't start a book going, I'm selfish and I will need to learn to be not selfish. They don't know. They don't know. This is their problem. And so that gives you a motivation. That gives you an arc that this character is going to follow. And that's their development through the book. And so what you do is you figure out, okay, what are all these people's problems that need to change? And then you figure out, well, who's against them. And then what is that opponent's problems? Why are they doing the things they're doing? And the goal is to have, my goal anyway, is to have every scene in my book is the result of a decision someone made for a good reason. Every scene, you know, nothing just happens in my novels. Every scene that we go into is because someone wanted to get something, or someone wanted to stop someone, or someone had a really great idea that turned out to be a really bad idea. You know, it's just every scene is because of something the characters did and is a result of a decision. And if you just do that, that is the definition of a character-driven story. The story is literally being driven by the decisions of the characters. And if you just keep following that, just let people point the people at where you want them to go and just let them gnaw their way to it, you will end up with a gripping drama. They desperately want whatever it is you've set them up for, and they will find a way to get it one way or another.
No, that's
or fantastic. Be horrifically and tragically defeated.
No, that's fantastic. So we're already running out of time here. So I'm going to switch.
No, I always talk too much. I'm sorry.
No, it's great. We're going to switch tack, because you had into the kind of marketing and the business side. You had this great post back in the spring when I first emailed you about marketing for the latest dragon book in the series. I think your husband wrote it, and it was
he's amazing.
And it was basically a list of all the different things that you'd done for marketing, the things that worked and things that didn't work. So what are what did you learn from that, and how do you recommend, I guess, marketing these later books in the series?
Well, we are actually in the middle of an experiment for my third book, No Good Dragon Goes Unpunished. We went the full court press. You know, we hired a marketing company to help us out. We did Facebook, we did Twitter, we did email, we did everything we could possibly think of. We did Google AdWords and Amazon ads and everything. And what we discovered was that a lot of stuff did not work. It just didn't matter how much money we put into it. We were not getting sales back. And the biggest strikeouts for us were the blog, actually, because I was doing all these blog posts and spending a lot of my time on blog posts, which I loved doing, by the way, except for writing nonfiction kind of drains me. So I find it very tiring to do. I like it. It's just, it's not like fiction, which gives me energy. I write fiction, I come out of it feeling like, yeah. I write nonfic, I feel like I come out feeling like I need another cup of coffee, you know? And, we discovered that the blog was not doing anything for the writing. It was doing nothing but sapping away my time, even though it was getting a lot of hits. So we decided to not do that anymore. Facebook and Twitter, same thing. We were doing a lot. We were posting a lot. We were spending a lot of money. We were trying desperately to engage, and we just were not seeing a return on our time investment and or our money investment. And we were just sort of like, well, you know, we gave it the college try. I guess we're done. And so now I'm doing my launch of my new book, which comes out at the end of July, and it's called The Dragon of a Different Color. And it's the fourth book in my dragon series, then the next to last one. And we're not doing any marketing for it. Like, I announced it. I did my email blast for it, but that's about it. We're not putting money into it or anything. And we're going to see how it's going to go, because so far it's already outselling book three. It's like, it's going better than book three was at this point with all that marketing. And so I'm like, well, I guess it really didn't make a damn bit of difference. A lot of caveats to this. My books are hard to market. I write books that cross genres. A lot of times people don't know they want my books until they see them. And how do you sell something, how do you sell someone something they don't know they want? Mm. You know, it's classic. So I have, if you're writing something that is much easier to very quickly describe in an ad, you might have better luck. Also, I am terrible at Facebook. I hate it. With the passion of 1,000 suns. And so I didn't engage as much there as I wanted, which, is fine. Honestly, if I had any advice about marketing, it would be experiment with a lot of different types and discover what the magical combination is: a marketing that actually does what you want it to do and that you enjoy doing, that you don't hate. Because if you hate it, that's going to come through. You're never going to be able to put on that much enthusiasm for it because you just hate it. And that's fine. Everyone hates something. But for me, like, that was Facebook. There are so many authors who have so much success at Facebook, and I'm just not one of them. I hate it. And, it hasn't hurt my career. So obviously I'm fine.
It is interesting. The blogging, I think, is really a very good point, because I agree with you. I don't think blogging is that useful for fiction authors. I think it's incredibly useful for nonfiction authors.
And I was trying to build a nonfiction platform before I realized I didn't actually want to be that person. I didn't want to have that career. I'm like, I don't want to do this. I want to write fiction. That's what I want to do. And so that was easy to draw. I will say the thing that worked really well, because there were some stuff that came out really well from this. And the number one thing we did that worked just amazingly was list bait for my mailing list. I had a mailing list that was probably about 1,800 people. So it was nice, but it wasn't huge. Mm. And we heard on the self-publishing podcast, actually, they were talking about using list bait. And my husband, Travis, who is the guy who comes up with all of this, by the way, I just sit in my writing cave and, like, growl at people, and he comes up with all the ideas. He's amazing. And, but he suggested I write a short story about in Heartstrikers we could offer to the mailing list. And I did, and it's called Mother of the Year. And it's really freaking funny. I think it's Bethesda, little Bethesda short, who is my terrible dragon mother. And, the worst person in the whole world, really. And she, I offered it to people who signed up for my mailing list, and signups went through the roof. I mean, I doubled my mailing list in the space of about 3 months, and it's now over doubled. I'm not actually sure how many we have. We have a lot. That's
probably affecting the launch of this next book.
Exactly. That's where I was getting to. I think that's why, because we did that mailing list launch and my sales just shot through the roof. And it's because these are people who have, when people sign up for your mailing list, these are people who want to be marketed to you, And they're the best customers, and you have to treat them really well. You can't, if someone signs up, this is something I got from actually when I went to Romantic Times in May, I went to a panel with Sarah from Smart Bitches, Sarah Wendell, who's brilliant. And she had a fantastic point about mailing lists, which is that a mailing list is a promise. If you say to someone, I'm going to email you only when I have new fiction, only email them when you have new fiction. You want your email to them to feel like a present. It's like a present in their box, not like, oh, it's that lady emailing me again. You want them to know what the email, if you say, I'm going to email you every day with awesome recipes, you'd better email them every day with awesome recipes. This is your promise that you have made this person who has given you their email. And you should never abuse that. I'm actually very much against authors who trade mailing lists because you're betraying your promise. They signed up for your mailing list, not that other author's mailing list. And it works, but I find it to be kind of disingenuous.
I agree. No. I think you can do joint promotions where you share something on your list, and then if they choose to sign up for someone else's, then great. But it's interesting, because what you're talking about there is creating something specifically for list sign up that is not available anywhere else. I haven't done, my Author 2.0 blueprint for nonfiction is exclusive, but I haven't got anything for fiction. And I keep thinking that.
It really is worth it.
Yeah, exactly. And that's a really good tip for people.
Because Well, the other thing is that you want the mailing list to feel exclusive. You want people to feel like they're getting stuff no one else has. And I'm like, and my mailing list people, they get first access to everything I do. They're always the first to know. I email something on my mailing list, it pops up on Twitter. Oh my God, guys, guess what I just found out? They get to be the first to tell their friends about your book. And the people get really excited about that. And when your fans are that excited about your book, that's amazing. That's like the best marketing that you can possibly have. So highly recommend making them. If you don't have a mailing list already, make one and make it awesome. Promise people something you can deliver. Like I only email people when I have a new book coming out. That's my promise. Cause I can keep it. Cause I suck at doing things monthly. I only email them when there's a new book, but the result is when my email comes in, everyone opens it. I have amazing open rates because they're really excited because they're the first on the block to know about new Rachel Aaron.
That's super excited. I think that's really great because there's a lot of push about growing an email list, but it's what you do with that that makes the real difference. So coming back to that blog post, it says at the end that you guys are looking at selective focus and drastically scaling back on some things. Now, this is something I keep saying I will do. So what did you decide about? You mentioned blogging that you're going to stop doing, but what else are you drastically scaling back to focus on?
We stopped the nonfiction blogging, which is kind of sad, but it was just eating hours and hours of my time that I needed for writing. We stopped Facebook ads. I stopped posting on Facebook as much because it was eating my time and eating our money and not giving anything back. And what you've really got to do is you've got to come up with a metric for measuring your advertising. You know, are you looking for book sales? Are you looking for views on your webpage? Are you looking for mailing list signups? Pick a number, like a hard number, and then do an experiment with a marketing to see if you can make that number bigger. And then when it's over, give it 3 months or something. Give it some time to actually work because marketing is slow. But when it's done and it's not doing what you want, cut it loose. Don't waste your time on things that don't work. Don't throw good money after bad. And as authors, we want desperately to do something. You want some button you can press to make your book sell because it can feel really powerless. You know, your poor little book is a fish in the vast ocean and you're trying to get attention. But so that's why you should always keep experimenting and be able to measure what you're doing. But you should never just keep doing something on blind faith because all you're doing at that point, you might as well be buying lottery tickets or throwing pennies into a wishing well. You know, you're just throwing money away if it's not working and you can't prove that it's working. What's the point? Like I actually stopped going to conventions because I love them. They were super fun. But I have a young child, so they put a lot of stress on my family because my husband had to do everything while I was gone. I got sick almost every time because you leave your hermetically sealed writer cave and go off into the wider world. They would often like wipe out about a week of work. And I'm like, I can't afford this. I'm not making enough fans and making enough connections to afford this. And I'm hoping that will change in the future because, again, conventions are really fun and I love them. But love wasn't good enough. The ROI was just not there. And so that's an example of things you just got to scale back. And so that's really what we did.
It's such an important...
Focus on what works.
Yeah. Exactly. Focus on what works or try things, like you say, as an experiment and then stop them if they're not working. I think... And things change. This is what's so really important. Like, I mean, you started off talking about 2004. The book marketing from 2004 is just completely,
it's all advertisements and like subway banners.
Yes.
And stuff.
Print newspapers or, you know, things have really changed and things will keep changing. And I think they're changing even faster. So everyone should revisit their, revisit your writing habits, revisit your marketing tactics. All of that. So I want to, last question, I want to just talk about working with your husband. So first of all, does that mean you're successful enough that you could hire your husband to work with you?
Yes, it does. Although if, we live in America and if healthcare gets gutted, we're going to be in a real problem because, we are self-employed. We formed our own company, but there's only two of us. And, we depend on the marketplaces to buy our health insurance. And we're already paying through the nose because my son has a cerebral palsy. So he has a pre-existing condition and he needs leg braces. And those are very, very expensive. And, all that stuff. And if I'm very, very worried. We might either have to move to Canada or my husband might have to get a job specifically to get health insurance.
And that, and you know, yeah. Consider Europe. You know, our healthcare is so much better than yours.
let me tell you, I'm thinking about moving to France.
Yeah, France is amazing. Yeah, France is like the number one. I mean, really, it's amazing. But it's just, you know.
But I love being American and I'm very American. So it's really, really upsetting to me on a deep level.
Fair enough. And we try not to be a political show, but exactly. I do but get, and
that healthcare thing is very big for all writers.
Yeah, it is a very important topic for people to consider if they want to write. I mean, getting a part-time job or something that covers it is a good idea. But secondly, what are your tips for working with a partner and also kind of communicating the understanding of what you do as a writer? I mean, you said now he's starting to write, but many mm-hmm. people listening don't get support from their partners. People don't understand why they want to do it or how long things might take. So what are your tips there for that sort of, you know, relationship?
Very clear divisions and responsibilities. Like one of the things that Travis and I are very lucky because we got together in 2002 and we basically just clicked. And we didn't get married till 2006. We've basically been married since like our very first date. It was ridiculous. We were just two puzzle pieces that snapped. It's great. I'm not going to lie. It's awesome. And I'm like, I'm so lucky. And he was like my second serious boyfriend I ever had. And I'm just like, I'm done. I never have to do this again. We're done here. And but what you really need to do is you need to have a very clear line of responsibility because, you know, In publishing is a very emotional business because it's your book. You know, you've put so much of yourself into this product. When stuff goes wrong and things do go wrong, like all the time, mm-hmm. you get mad. You get very mad. And knowing who's responsible for what keeps you from just being mad because you never want to poison your loving relationship with, why didn't you do that thing? You know, you don't want to be that. So what we do is we have a very clear division of labor and things that we are responsible for. He does, and we do it based on our personalities, what we like to do. Like I do all the writing and I take care of all the freelancers, like my editors and my cover artists, and I do the covers and everything basically before the book is published is me. That's all me. And then once the book is published, it kind of goes into Travis's domain because he handles the money, the business, the looking at stuff, keeping, listening to all the podcasts, keeping updated. At this point, he knows more about publishing than I do because he's the one who's really educating himself and staying on top of things and coming up with all the cool new marketing ideas. And because that's what he likes to do. He genuinely enjoys marketing. He loves spreadsheets and numbers. He's a numbers guy. And so it just works really, really well. And he also, you know, he takes care of the house and he's my house husband in a lot of ways, and which is great and which has saved us a lot of heartache. And because it's very difficult to, like, you know, keep a functional house when you're both working full time. So my duties for him are really part time and he spends the rest of his time doing house stuff. And I let him make his schedule however he wants. So long as it gets done, I don't care. I'm like, if it gets done, I'm fine. I just need these things done by these days. And he does them. And he's a very responsible spouse. And I think that's really important because we're both pretty responsible people. So we have a lot of trust. And not everyone's relationship is like that. And that's not to like hate on anyone, but we just are very lucky that we already had a good working relationship. So it was very easy for us. For other people, you may have to, if you want to work with your spouse, you may have to be very, very specific about what they're going to do. But those set responsibilities really help people know what is expected of them. And if people know what is expected of them, you get a lot less conflict. And that's true in any business. That's true in any business. And however, you know your significant other, you know your spouse. It may seem like kind of a nice idea, oh, we should work together, but you know in your heart of hearts whether or not that's a good idea. And sometimes it's better off, you're better off spending your money just hiring an assistant.
I think that's a really good point. And also, you know, when you're the one who starts the thing, like when you're the writer, it's tempting to just try and give them the stuff you don't want to do. And that might not be what they're actually best at. So, you know, just an amusing question. I find myself assigning my husband Asana tasks, which is, you know, like sharing software. And I'm like, oh, he needs to do that. I'm going to put it in Asana. And then it's like, I'm giving my spouse a task on Asana. This is a bit naughty.
Important thing here is that with Travis and myself is you know, again, where you got to have, you assign tasks. I just kind of give him a category and he does it. Mm. And it really was whatever works. And it's the personality of the person. And you just, you really got to watch out for becoming a boss as opposed to a partner.
Yeah, exactly.
You can't, like, this is my business. I'm the one who makes the money. I'm the one who decides what we're writing. But I'm a pretty alpha person. Mm. Whereas Travis is much more laid back. You know, he's not really a guy who's going to give other people instructions. He's a guy who's very responsible and is going to get that job done. Mm-hmm. And that's why I married him. And I love him for that, because he is the person who gets stuff done. He just does it. You don't have to say anything to him. He's just super responsible. And I love that. And I find that so, you know, supportive and fulfilling. But if you have a spouse and you don't trust them to do what you need them to do, getting them into your business is just it's the road to failure. It's the road to a lot of heartache. So you've got to be very careful when you do this to make sure that it's actually going to work out. Because a lot of spouses, and I've seen this in other authors, they either see the author as a meal ticket, or they don't really understand what you're doing and they're not legitimately interested in publishing. And so they're always kind of about it. You know, they don't really put their heart and soul into it like someone you could hire would do, because they also want to be in publishing. So yeah. Motivation is very big.
Yeah, I think, and these are all really fantastic tips. And Jonathan and I are coming up to 2 years in a couple of months working together. And I keep saying to him, he has to come on the podcast. I have to interview him on the podcast about me and how we've managed it. Because I think it's something that a lot of people want, and then it might not necessarily be exactly how you imagined it. So
exactly. Also something that feels very natural. You know, it's like, oh, well, I stay at home and write all day. Why don't you stay at home and help me all day? Yeah. And then we can just both be at home and it'll be great. And it is great if you can make it work. Because some couples I know, they kind of need 8 hours apart from each other. Yeah. And then they come to, and they're fine, you know, and they do very well, but they need their apart time. And it's just personality. There's no right or wrong way to have a relationship. So long as it's not an abusive relationship.
Yeah, exactly. Well, look, we've covered a whole load of really interesting topics today. So where can people find you and all your books online?
Oh, well, if you go to rachelaron.net, and that is rachelaron.net, I have everything there. All the blog posts we talked about, you know, the original 2K to 10K post, the marketing post. I post sales numbers. We actually have got some sales numbers, some new ones to post. They're pretty cool. All my information about KU, everything that we did that's on the blog, it's all still there. You can go read it and you can just link that right off my website, which is rachelaron.net again. And it's also where you can find all of my books, traditional and indie published. They're all on my website. And there's audio editions of everything. There's print editions of everything. There's ebooks of everything. So whatever you like, I've got it. Just come read about dragons. They're super fun.
Right. Well, thanks so much for your time, Rachel. That was great.
Thank you. This has been a marvelous interview. I've had a really good time. Anytime you want to do it again, just let me know.
I hope you enjoyed the interview with Rachel today. And next week, I'm talking to Jeff Goines about why real artists don't starve and how creativity, business, and money have always been intertwined. And we have a great chat. Jeff and I have kind of been talking on and off online for years, so it was great to have him back on the show. And of course, remember to pick up your copy of How to Market a Book, the third edition, if you want to sell more books and reach more readers. Available now in ebook and print editions. Okay, happy writing, and see you next time. Thanks for listening today. I hope you found it helpful. You might also like the backlist episodes and show notes available at thecreativepen.com/podcast. You can also get your free author blueprint at thecreativepen.com/blueprint. If you'd like to connect, you can tweet me at The Creative Pen or find me on Facebook at The Creative Pen. See you next time.